Support for this show comes from Slack. You're a growing business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Recode Media with Peter Kafka. That is me. And when you take a war in the Middle East and you add the New York Times and a controversial headline, you get a really big story, one that is reverberating more than a week later. My guest, Charlotte Klein, she's a media reporter for Vanity Fair, just added a significant chapter to the story. She's been able to give us an inside look at how Times staff grappled with the hospital explosion story in real time. It's a great story. You should go read it right now and then come listen to this podcast. Welcome, Charlotte.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for doing this. Before we get to your story, can you briefly catch us up on the entire history of conflict in the Middle? No. Can you briefly catch us up on the overall story about the explosion in Gaza last week and the way the Times covered it?
Yeah. So basically, there was an explosion in the parking lot of a hospital in Gaza, and the Times initially sent out an alert that said it was an Israeli airstrike and attributed that claim to Palestinian officials. I don't know if they were among the first, but it wasn't like it was a scoop, you know. I mean, I think that the wire sent up less. And then a few minutes or maybe an hour later that Israel said, you know, we're looking into it, we're not entirely sure, but it basically came out that the Times' source was the Hamas-backed Palestinian health ministry. So, I mean, I think that a lot of news outlets, the Times was not alone. You know, the Wall Street Journal also attributed it to an Israeli airstrike, CNN, Reuters, Al Jazeera. I think it became clear pretty quickly that this was not, at least if not an Israeli airstrike, just not verified to be an Israeli airstrike. And so there was kind of a rush to conclusions there.
Yeah, so this is very much a fog of war story. It's happening in real time. The Times is technically correct, which was there was some sort of explosion, and Hamas officials were essentially saying this is an Israeli airstrike, and it killed hundreds. So they reported it accurately, but sort of, as they've now said in a pretty extraordinary editor's note, said basically we probably gave people the wrong information, or at least we weren't as accurate as we could be. They won't say yeah, they're incorrect, but they're saying we didn't handle this correctly.
Right. And I think that, like you said, it definitely is a fog of war situation. I don't think this is the first story we've seen out of this war, which has only been going on for a few weeks, where news outlets are sort of caught in that. But I do think that, and, you know, Joe Kahn, the executive editor of The New York Times, in addition to the editor's note, went on a Times podcast on Monday, and he, you know, addressed the editor's note. And he said in that interview that, you know, they change headlines all the time. These are developing stories, which is totally true. And these are developing stories. But I think the fact that, you know, this is obviously a very contentious moment, I think that the Times and other news organizations just had to be even more careful than usual.
And for context, because the Times has come in for a lot of criticism, and I think a lot of it's well-deserved, but, you know, there were people I was seeing on Twitter who were complaining that CNN, for instance, wasn't covering the airstrike correctly because they weren't referring to children being killed, And at one point they'd said innocent civilians, and I think Anderson Cooper changed it sort of on air to civilians, and they were angry about that. So there was anger that initially that mainstream organizations weren't portraying this sympathetically enough to the Palestinian cause. So
right.
We're not doing equivalents here, but just to, no one was happy with any of the coverage, but a lot of the focus has been on the Times because it's the Times, I think, is the right. fairest way to put it. So tell us about your story because it's quite extraordinary.
Thank you. So I obtained internal Slack messages. They, you know, among New York Times editors and reporters, it took place in a Slack that had some 500 members, but it's open to anyone at the Times. And it's just like, it's called Israel Briefings. It's basically where they're just going back and forth about all of this coverage with the Israel-Hamas war. And, you know, I think a lot of people in the aftermath of, particularly like the Times editor note, but I don't think anyone had forgotten about it, but I think it's been on their mind this week because the Times put the editor's note out the day before my story, but maybe people felt like there wasn't enough conversation within the Times about this story. And I think people just assume that these things are, or maybe it's the alternative. Maybe people think like everyone there agreed that this was the right way to do it. And I think what I was able to obtain, which are these Slack messages between, there's sort of two separate exchanges. One is an exchange between a senior news editor and so they have like their news editors and live editors, and then they have their international, there's two groups of people here, and then their international reporter and editor. And, you know, you kind of see this conflict between the people who are running the live team trying to get this news up as quickly as possible. Understandably, that's their job. And then you have, you know, these people who are much more, I would say, embedded in likely what I'm speculating is the day-to-day of covering this. And so essentially you have the first exchange was an editor saying that they wanted to be more direct in the lead by saying, I think they said 500 people killed in this strike, Israeli airstrike, Palestinian authorities said. And then another editor says, you know, you don't want to hedge it. And a reporter chimes in, better to hedge. And then the other editor says, we're tributing.
So this is a live debate sort of in real time about how should we write this story? What should this headline be? Should we go with the story that says Palestinian officials say? Should we hedge it more? So the people who think that, I mean, it's kind of extraordinary. I would hate to have people looking over my shoulder while I was working on a story in real time. But that's essentially what you're allowing us to do, is to watch this debate within the Times about how do we cover this.
Yeah, sorry. Not to recount the entire exchange. Yeah, I think that it is this sort of fascinating look into, you know, how things are happening in real time. And as you can see in these exchanges, it's obviously quick because they're breaking news, but it's just also like sort of split seconds decisions that, you know, individual people are making. It's not like, you know, Joe Kahn has later said that he and a bunch of other editors were weighing in on this, which I'm sure they were. But, you know, these are people, you know, running the website, making split second decisions. And I think that, you know, it's understandable, but it is sort of fascinating to see. Also, just in terms of like timestamps, in terms of like talking about it, deciding to double down, waffling, not changing the actual reference to, quote, Israeli strike until, you know, an hour later.
I think the crucial quote here in your story, I'm just going to read it. You attribute this to an international news editor, says, I think we just can't hang the attribution of something so big on one source without having tried to verify it, and then slap it across the top of the homepage. Putting the attribution at the end doesn't give us cover if we've been burned and we're wrong. That looks pretty prescient now. But, you know, it could have gone the other way. It could have been an accurate story at the beginning. And I think people who are criticizing the Times are right to do so, but I think they're also probably a little naive about how this stuff gets put together. It is well-meaning people trying to make decisions very quickly.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, I do think that statement looks very prescient now. I think that something that was interesting to me, I mean, this is getting a little bit in the weeds in terms
That's what we're here for.
Okay. you know, there's this difference in the Slack messages I obtained. They're sort of talking about the difference between the blog headline and the homepage headline. And so I think what happened in this period of time was, you can see, I think at 1:36, the Times live blog had their first post about this blast at the Gaza hospital. And then, you know, by 2 something, it was the banner across the homepage. And here the editors are kind of debating, because one editor says, you know, the head on the homepage goes way too far, and another editor says it's saying the same thing the blog head does, both attributing to Palestinians. And he's kind of making a difference, which I think is interesting in terms of like people going to the homepage and seeing this giant banner headline, which, by the way, had a photo underneath it of destruction that wasn't even this hospital. So that was kind of misleading. But also, you know, things are happening fast. And then also, yeah, so I think that there's some nuances in sort of how they're communicating these stories.
I have some process questions for you. You don't identify any of the journalists involved. You obviously know who they are. Their names are in the Slack. Why keep their names out of the story?
I mean, we felt what was most important was the exchange and sort of the glimpse at the real-time discussions and decision-making. And decision-making is about the framing of the story. I think that this is obviously a very contentious time. And I didn't feel like the point of the story was to go after these specific editors or reporters or, you know, or whatnot. I think this is more, the point of the story is more just a look at how these decisions get to be, you know, come about in an institution of that size.
Were you concerned that the people who are angry about the Times would then go after editor X, Y, or Z or junior staffer Z?
I mean, I don't think that's a crazy concern. I think that's a pretty, you know, like, I'm not writing this to kind of put certain people on, you know, on blast. I'm not trying to get anybody, you know, called out publicly. It's more just these are the people. And, you know, obviously it probably would have been a different thing if, like, these names were, you know, if it was like Joe Kahn writing in the Slack, maybe mm-hmm. that would have been a different consideration. But we felt that knowing what we knew, taking the names out was the right call.
So, as you said, this is a Slack channel that lots of people at the Times could have accessed. Obviously, you're not going to tell me who gave you access, but do you have an understanding of what the motivation of the person who said, I want you to look at these Slack messages was?
Yeah, so I think there was some frustration that the editor's note, and, you know, other people outside of the Times have noted this, the editor's note, it was sort of acknowledging that they got it wrong, but I think some people inside the Times and also outside felt that it didn't fully hold accountable some of the people behind the decision, and also it wasn't really specific. I mean, like, the editor's note itself didn't even link to any of the coverage. I think it was very broad, and you know, as editor's notes are, I think Joe Kahn talked about this in his interview, it's like they're addressing a moment, not so much a specific piece. But I think that people felt that there was still sort of a black box over how this decision was made. And I think that people also felt like, you know, it was, you know, rank and file staff who were pushing back against this decision and sort of, as you see in the Slack exchanges, being overruled, which is obviously how a newsroom works. Like, I don't have any doubt about that. But I think that there was at least a few people who wanted people to know that it wasn't just a, you know, unanimous decision.
Yeah, to put a fine point on it, there's a couple ways you can read your story, right? And you can imagine the motivation for someone giving you the access for that story. One is, look how we screwed up. You should explain this to the world. Or look, we were trying our best to get it right, and we got it wrong. Mm-hmm. Which one of those do you think what do you think the motivator was for the person who reached out to you or provided you with this Slack?
I think it's the latter. Maybe that's optimistic. But I don't know. I mean, I think maybe somewhere in between those two options too. I think that it's, you know, like I think what places like the Times are doing is incredibly hard, especially in this kind of a situation. And I don't fault, you know, I think they made the wrong call, but I think it's good that they acknowledge it in the editor's note. Like, I don't know the last time Joe Kahn has gone on a podcast to talk about something like this either. But I also think that there was clearly more to it than they publicly acknowledged, which is why I felt like that was a good insight.
As an aside, they're still being incredibly measured about the way they talk about what happened at that hospital. They have yet to say, we think this is Palestinian rockets, or we think this is Israel. Last night, they put up a story that says, here's this forensic evidence that the U.S. and Israel are using to say that this is a Palestinian rocket, and we think that evidence is wrong. They go into great detail about how they think that evidence is wrong, and they still won't say who they think is responsible for the actual explosion.
A lot of other organizations
have. The Wall Street Journal this weekend has a video saying, here's how a Palestinian rocket landed on the hospital, and there's no hedging at all about it. The journal just says this happened.
Yeah, I saw that visual investigation. It's really interesting because also, like, you know, I love Times visual investigations. I think they're great. I mean, I think it's one of their best, you know, teams. And I think, I wonder if we would maybe be looking at that visual investigations differently had all of this not happened. And, you know, I think the tough part about this, and I wanted to try to be clear about this in my story, is like, there are a lot of things that are unknown still about this. And that's what's sort of hard, is like, even though the US and others have said that they believe it was an errant Palestinian missile, and you have these different outside analysis saying the same, you know, we still don't really know. But I think that aside from all of that, we can at least agree that the Times shouldn't, especially based on the internal conversations we now know happened, have rushed it out.
What would the correct headline have been at and around the time of the explosion, do you imagine?
Maybe, I think, just not Israeli, you know, attributing blame. Like, I don't, because you didn't have to attribute blame, right? You could have just said,
large explosion at Gaza hospital appears to have killed many people.
Yeah. And then you see in the Slack exchanges, they're actually like, we could actually be more precise in the lead. And that was something that, you know, Lulu asked Joe Kahn about in the interview, which was like, this wasn't a scoop. And given the nature of what Hamas has done, why race to get it out? But I do think, I mean, a lot of people, I didn't really get into it in my piece, but a lot of people do talk about the competitiveness and sort of the mistakes that can be made in the rush to get it out. Mm-hmm. Jessica Lesson, you know, tweeted my story and noted something that I thought was interesting, talking about the tension between the live team and the international editors and kind of how they're doing different kinds of work. But I don't know. I mean,
I can imagine people would have been very upset with that headline too. Again, not to do equivalence, but they would have said, well, why don't you assign blame for this rocket?
Right.
I did want to broaden this a little bit. I have been calling people at the Times the last few days and saying, hey, when am I going to see a story about people at the Times tearing each other apart on Slack? Because I'm used to those stories now. They were a major, major piece of the George Floyd, BLM, pandemic era. Lots of individual staffers, particularly Barry Weiss, but a lot of other folks said, I'm being harassed here. Eventually, the Times sort of had to come out and say, everyone's got to get it together on Slack and behave better, and also we're going to make some structural changes. But this is still I'm trying to find generic ways to describe. It's a war between Israel and Palestinians and Hamas, and you would think there would be people in the Times who are upset about what other people in the Times are doing, either coverage-wise or what they're saying in Slack. And so when your story first popped up, I said, oh, that's got to be the story that I was looking for. Obviously, you're covering something else. Why do you think we haven't heard about infighting at the Times about coverage of this war?
I would say a few things. I would say, one, it's early. Like, I think this war it was a few weeks ago, right? I think Barry Weiss actually had a piece sort of drawing an equivalence between why she's sort of saying the whole thing, talking about the difference between 2020 and now. I mean, look, I think I know that there are other conversations happening in Slack channels other than the ones I reported. I mean, mine was much more process oriented. I did see, you know, a source told me about a different Slack where someone, and it's a Slack that's sort of like an ask an editor type thing, and an editor raised a concern about the Israel story, Israel-Gaza strike story, and sort of wondered why they are asked. It's like they're asked, expecting Hamas to justify, to prove that they didn't do it, and they don't do the same thing for Russia in stories about attacks on Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And there was sort of this whole back and forth about that. And this person was like, it took us months to assign culpability to Ukrainians, and this has only been going on for a few weeks, and we're very quick to, you know, give Israel the benefit of the doubt. And so those conversations are happening. That was just one example that I heard about. But I think you also had a few things like in 2020. First of all, it's to my understanding, I don't really know the specifics of it, but I do know that I think they've cracked down a little bit on Slack in general inside the Times.
There used to be sort of a main Slack where everyone who worked at the New York Times could pop off, and I think that no longer exists. I think one of us should probably verify that, but yeah. that's our belief from two media reporters.
Yeah, I remember just a story I was doing like a few months ago. This might have been around the trans issues at the Times. And it was something, someone had mentioned something where basically you can't just like pop in and ask, you know, any question. And these sort of, I think around in 2020 during the National Working, there were these forums where people could kind of just pose any question. But I also think the fact that everyone was at home, and it was also just a different, I mean, there is a difference, I think, between a National Reckoning and a foreign war. I mean, I think it's apples and oranges. Like, I don't think we can weigh them in the same way, but I do think it was just a different time.
Someone suggested to me that some part of the BLM issue was talking about the Times as an employer, and right now that's not the case. I'm not wishing that the Times has internal strife, but I do imagine that there's going to be more to this story. Charlotte Klein is the media reporter at Vanity Fair. Her story is called "You Don't Want to Hedge It," inside the New York Times debate over its Gaza hospital bombing coverage. If you have got to this part of the podcast and you have not read her story, go read it. Charlotte, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks again to Travis and Jelani and Jolie Myers as well. Thanks to our sponsors, and thanks to our listeners. This is Recode Media. We'll see you soon.